What other ways can we cut this data and information when we're talking to other people about this amazing industry?
It's things like, rather than saying one turbine can power 16,000 European households, instead of saying that, you say one spin can power a home for over 2 days. And people get that. You know, it's important to engage with the public so they can make informed decisions about how they're voting, about how they think about things.
What can we do in practical terms to make that better? Because there is clearly a lack of diversity, not just diversity, however you measure it, right? But whichever metric you're looking at, we're not doing very well on it. What do we do?
Okay, but then there's areas like disability, neurodiversity, socioeconomic background and things like that, where that people just aren't even aware of that.
If this takes two generations to fix, it's just not good. It's just not, that's not good enough.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back for another episode of Modo, the podcast. Today, Quentin is joined by Juliet Sanders, Director of Strategic Communications at Energy UK. You may also know Juliet as Killer Jules on YouTube. Over the course of the conversation, they discuss the importance of communications and how we can include everybody on the journey to net zero. If you're enjoying the podcast, please give it a like and subscribe. It really means the world to us. And with that, let's jump in.
Okay, so which Juliet am I speaking to? Am I speaking to Juliet Sanders or am I speaking to Killer Jules?
Right now, he's speaking to Juliet Sanders. In a minute, I'll go put my turbine suit on and then you'll know that you're speaking to Killer Jules.
Okay. All right, so one of those mime artists that turns left and right with different clothes on. All right, so Juliet, thanks very much for coming on the podcast. We've known each other for a little while. We saw you at the Modo Energy Party about a year ago. And we've been big fans of what you've been doing on YouTube for a long time. Oh, that's a Killer Jules, actually. We're just talking about Juliet Sanders right now. If you wouldn't mind, could you just give a brief overview of Juliet Sanders for our audience and what you do at Energy UK?
Absolutely. And also big fans of you guys as well. So thanks very much for having me on.
Thank you.
So Juliet Sanders by day. My job is Director of Strategic Communications at Energy UK. So we're the trade body that represents most of industry. So that's everything from retail suppliers to generators of all kinds and pretty much everything in between. So EV charging companies, heat pump companies, flexibility providers, all sorts of companies across the whole industry. But we don't represent upstream oil and gas and we don't represent distribution network operators. But apart from that, we pretty much have the whole sector. And what that means
is that on purpose, by the way? So it's the Venn diagram, which is stuff you do represent and not oil and gas and not coal, I think, and not upstream. How do you define who can and can't join?
Well, we have members that do have oil and gas operations, but it's just that we don't represent that side of the industry. So where we're doing our sort of lobbying and advocacy, it's only based on the other generation forms. It's not based on upstream extraction or anything like that. Okay. And then the distribution network operators, they're represented by ENA, the Energy Networks Association. So they've got their whole trade body for that. But apart from that, yeah, we do pretty much the whole sector. And that means that basically when we're speaking to government and we're trying to advise on policy, that we can take that whole sector view. And our members can then feed into that as well.
And how big is Energy UK?
Tiny for what we do. I think we punch well above our weight. I think there's only about 50 of us there. So it's the main organisation is split into policy and comms, and then there's kind of services around that. But we do loads of events. We've just brought in these new events this year, Lightning Bolt Talks, which are really cool, kind of data led, like in the pub basement, and you get five people giving 5 minute talks about how data is driving forward the energy industry. We do big peace conferences, and then really what our members get out of us is a lot of insight in terms of political insight, regulatory insight. So the government or the regulator might come to us to get an industry view, and then we're able to project that back to them and work with them to get the right policy in place.
And so members, how do you join? I know this isn't a sales conversation, so I'm assuming
it is a sales conversation. Everyone listening should go to the website and join. Yeah, it's really easy now because we've just revamped our website last year. Yeah, so if you just head to the website, speak to our membership team, they'd be really happy to speak to you. But as I said, there's loads of benefits. It's the analysis and insight and the shaping of the policy, really. And then that we can then also help to raise the profile of that company. So we'll be using examples from our members when we're talking to the most senior politicians, when we're talking to media, because we don't have any assets ourselves, which I used to work for companies, big developers, where you'd have the wind farms and it'd be really exciting and you'd get to go out to them. This kind of an organisation where it's more lobbying, we don't own anything like that. So we need to speak to industry to understand and really bring those bits to life of what we're talking about, really.
And before this, you've done lots of things in different energy companies, right? So big utilities. I've seen some photos of you on offshore wind turbines. You've been everywhere.
I have, yeah. I've been really lucky in my career, I think. So I studied engineering at uni, and then I went to do a grad scheme at EDF. And as part of that, I did 6 months in the media team. I won't lie, it was partly because they were sponsoring the Olympics and I thought it would be fun. So I did that and I thought I'll just do it for 6 months and then I'll go back to an analytical role. But I actually really missed the media side of things. I just love it because it's really fast paced and you get, like you say, you get to do all the fun stuff. So like, I've stood on top of a nuclear reactor, I've gone up to the top of a wind turbine with a film crew. You get a lot of opportunities from it. So I feel very fortunate that I've had those in my career. Yeah.
And so for Energy UK and your members, what are the hot topics? What's the state of play at the moment? You guys speak with government a lot.
Yeah.
What's going on?
What's going on? Where do I start? Well, I guess firstly, people first, right? All the time. So we're coming up to winter. It's going to be, you know, another tough winter, I think, for very many people. And we're in a different place to where we were last year in terms of people will have dipped into a lot of savings. Quite a lot of the government support has gone as well. So I think there's an immediate need to look at affordability for this winter. And the second kind of part of it is around the investment landscape. So we've seen massive offshore wind projects pull out in the UK. You'll have just seen that allocation round five basically fell over. Absolutely no offshore wind in that, fixed bottom or floating. And we've just done a series of analysis with Oxford Economics, which showed that out of the largest eight economies in the world, the UK is predicted to have the slowest growth for low carbon generation. And a lot of that is being driven by this investment landscape, which is windfall tax on generators that's more punitive than oil and gas. So it's quite a crunchy time in the energy industry because right now is exactly the wrong time to be giving any investors any doubts of that the UK is the best place to place your projects, because you've got increased competition from IRA in the US and all the stuff happening in Europe and China and India. So yeah, I think that's a big part of it. So the people, the investment, and then there's like the nuts and bolts, like the how do you get it all to work together? And that's like the boring stuff, but it's also really important, like planning reform and making sure that like institutes are well staffed enough so that they can handle all the planning applications that are going to come through in the next however many years. If you think from now to 2030, just looking at offshore wind, right, we've got to build four times as much as we've got right now. And as I said, just had an auction where none of the projects, you know, no projects bid in. And every single year that we waste between now and 2030 is critical to meeting that energy security target. And you can't
I just ask you about that. So we've got to build four times as much offshore wind as we do have right now. So we've got 8 years to do that, pretty much.
If my maths is right, we need to get 50 gigawatts. We've got about 12 gigawatts now. In my head, that's about four times.
And who set the 50 gigawatts?
Well, initially it was 30 gigawatts. So as part of the sector deal, which I think was 2016, government and industry had this strong partnership building on the reason that we were so good at offshore wind is because of the CFDs, right? And because government and industry worked together to get this mechanism that works, that gave investors and project developers the confidence of the price that they'd get back in the long term. So yeah, initially it was 30 gigawatts and then it went up to 40 gigawatts and then it went up to 50 gigawatts as part of the energy security strategy. So that's the government's target.
This isn't us saying we need this. This is government saying,
it's government saying we need it for energy security. But also industry has all along been like, we can deliver if the right framework is in place. But then if you are spooking off investors by taxing electricity generation companies or the right framework isn't there. Investors need long-term certainty. That's the point. And so if you're not giving them that, or as we saw in allocation round five, where like the strike price wasn't at the right level because it didn't take into account all the changes in supply chain and the rises in inflation, things like that. So if the right framework is there, then we can build it, but you can't backload it. This is the point, is because there's only so many vessels, there's only so many cable manufacturers, there's only so many people. So we can't just suddenly do it all in the last few years. It needs to be a really steady growth. And we've just missed a year of that now. So yeah, we'll see.
So we're already behind.
Yes.
So we've got some catching up to do.
But it is an industry that has completely surpassed expectations before, both on growth and on cost. Nobody foresaw how cheap they could get the price and how quickly they could grow by. And that's down to investment in the supply chain, innovation, like the bigger turbine. Every year they're getting bigger and bigger, so you can get more. So it brings down the cost because you don't need as many to get the same amount of power. But then equally with that, it's going to have to become a point where it levels out, because you can't get the turbine manufacturers every year updating all their kits so that you're building bigger and bigger stuff. So yeah, I think as an industry, it's certainly one that's delivered and gone above and beyond before. So I'm sure we can do it if we get the next auction right.
And you mentioned something else there that's clearly important to the folks that you represent, which is about tax. And you compared tax on low carbon generation versus tax on fossil fuel extraction, I think you said, or I can't remember, yeah. Maybe I'm paraphrasing. What do you mean by that?
So there's the energy profits levy, I think it's called, which is what the government put in place on the fossil fuel extraction companies. And that involves a lot of tax back, so that for every kind of pound they invest in stuff, then they get a certain amount back. Then there was a windfall tax on low carbon generators, which was called the electricity profits levy. And at the minute, that's more punitive.
Definitely not a windfall then, tax.
Rather. Yeah, not a windfall. No. It's an electricity profits levy, but that's more punitive at the minute than what's on the oil and gas companies. So our argument is at least make it the same. Really should be incentivizing these kinds of technologies. And actually, if you look at what's happening in America, where you are, they've just done the IRA, where it's hundreds of billions of pounds attracting companies, not just for the developers, but it's also in the supply chain as well, and making sure that they're building up the local supply chain there. And we need a response to that, where even if we can't compete on the subsidies, whether it's capital allowances or something like that, we need to make sure that it's clear that the UK is an attractive place to invest. And that's also about long-term certainty, about more than as much as it is about the money. It's just about having the clear policy framework where people know what they're going to get, essentially.
So we've talked a little bit about offshore wind. It's been a tough few months for offshore wind. We've had projects that we thought were going to get built, put on hold, mothballed, or even cancelled. And then the CFD news was pretty tough. What do we do to fix that? You guys are probably going to government with solutions. So what are the solutions?
I think in offshore wind, government, to be fair to them, they met with industry the week after that announcement and to talk about AR6 and the changes that need to happen there. I think it's about having a strike price that reflects the current market status. Absolutely has to reflect the increases in costs that developers are facing. Then it's about having the right round size, so the right sort of volume available within the auction. And then it's about this long-term certainty, so getting clarity and getting all of that information out as soon as you can so that then developers can plan. So yeah, I think it's, yeah, I don't think it's fully fallen down yet. I think if they make the right changes, and I think government is listening, I think the message has landed now. We did a lot of work prior to AR5 to say this is what's going to happen if you don't change it, and lo and behold, that is what happened. So yeah, hopefully now we're on a trajectory where we can work more closely together.
The current UK government, it feels like there's been a bit of back and forth of changing direction about whether they're pro-wind or anti-wind or pro-solar or anti-solar. I know some of that is a product of the amount of prime ministers we've had in a very short amount of time.
More secretaries of state for energy.
Even more secretaries of state.
Yeah.
So we're going to solve one thing, probably just have one direction on that stuff. But where are we at now? It's the current government, and we're doing this in September 2023. Government, are they pro-wind or are they anti-wind? And of course, it's not black and white like that, right? What are they worried about? What's the base concerned about? And what is actually achievable in convincing our current government to be more friendly to wind?
I wouldn't say they're anti offshore wind. The main thing is they are committed to the net zero target, and they've reaffirmed that loads of times. So that's good, because there was a period a few months back where net zero was being bandied around in the media. And in the run-up to a general election, you're always going to get these sort of sensationalist stories in the media. And it's really important not to get dragged into that and to actually look what is happening in Westminster. Is that changing policy or not? So I'd say they are committed to net zero, but they also seem committed to oil and gas extraction. Onshore wind has effectively been banned in England for a while now. And so they've committed to looking at it, I think, but not quite got there with the regulation and putting it in legislation yet. So at the minute in England, one person can block an onshore wind farm proposal, which is crazy when you think it, literally just one person can block a whole project. And that's led to...
In the planning process.
Yeah. So, which when you think about the importance of renewables to the national energy mix and energy security, it's a bit mad. But yeah, there's a stat that Ukraine built more onshore wind than the UK, no, than England did in the last year, 100 times more, which when you think about that, there's no absolutely no reason for that. So they've committed to looking at that. But then, like I say, there's a lot.
That sounds like a very naughty statistic, because if the answer is like, we've got one turbine somewhere.
It is a bit like that. Yeah, yeah. We've built 1 megawatt. Sorry. We've built 1 megawatt. They've built 114 megawatts. I can't remember.
Yeah, okay.
We built 1 megawatt over two turbines, I think. In England, not UK. Scotland has been building away because it's different regulations there. Yeah. So I think they recognise there's a big mix. They've bet the government, the current government, as part of the energy security strategy, has bet big on offshore wind and nuclear. And that's why I think it was so shocking that they weren't listening with AR5, because that's what we've bet our money on, right? That offshore wind is going to be the backbone of the UK's electricity system. You know, and again, with floating, we had a real opportunity with floating offshore wind, really, as the UK to lead the way. And there were no floating projects either. So it does seem like a bit of a missed opportunity. But I think what we're going to see in the next few months when we get up to election time is everything's just going to go out the window. So we're really trying to make sure that energy stays at the top of the agenda and doesn't sort of get waylaid, really.
Can you just give a post-mortem on what happened on AR5, which is, for our listeners who aren't CFD experts, how do these allocation rounds happen? And surely if they were designed to get lots of offshore wind, why didn't we end up with lots of offshore wind?
Well, so contracts for difference work by agreeing a strike price between the government and an offshore wind developer or project. And that means that it lowers the cost of capital overall for the project, because then there's some certainty in the price that they'll get back for the electricity that they generate. So it works both ways, in the sense of when the electricity price is lower than what you've agreed, then there's a top up that's paid to the developer. And when the electricity price is higher, as we saw last year when there was really high electricity prices in the UK, then actually those projects end up paying back to the system. So it's a fair system, but because of that certainty, it's enabled the industry to bring down the costs massively. What happened with AR5 is that the administrative strike price, so like the maximum that they're able to bid in with, was not reflective of the overall market conditions at the minute, because there's obviously been massive cost increases in things like supply chain, and therefore no projects, they couldn't make the business case in order to bid in. They have to be able to make money. They can't do this stuff for free. It's billions of pounds of capex to invest in an offshore wind farm. And so the strike prices weren't right, and therefore no one bid in.
So the government, or the low carbon contracts company, or whoever it is, sets a cap on what you can bid in as your price, and your pounds per megawatt hour. And the cap was too low for anyone to bid in at a level that made money. Is that what happened?
Yeah, but the auctions always, they work in a way where the lowest price wins. So even if it was higher, it doesn't mean that it would have been at that price. It still could have come in lower, but it just no one could make it work, essentially.
Well, hopefully we're going to fix that somehow. All right, so we talked quite a bit there about offshore wind, but actually we're here to talk about what you do, which is, well, tell us what you do at Energy UK.
Yeah, sure. So I'm Director of Comms. So in my team, we've got media, public affairs, events, membership and digital. So between us, I like to think of us, we're like the front of house of a restaurant. So we've got all the chefs cooking up all the policy positions in the back, and then we're getting them out and making sure that they're communicated well. So yeah, that the comms side of things can range from, I guess on the public affairs side, it's about liaising with government parliamentarians to make sure they've got the right information so that they're making informed policy decisions. On the media side, we represent industry, especially when there's big industry-wide issues, or for example with AR5 and things like that, we're responding to that side of things. I think for us, we're quite a small team, and so sometimes you can have something on the retail side at the same time as something on the generation side, and it's just everything's happening at once on the same day, which can be fun to deal with. Yeah, and then we also look after events, so we have like big conferences. We've got our annual conference on the 18th of October this year, 2023. We do a lot of work in the EDI space as well, so diversity for industry. So yeah, we take industry's view and get it out there, whether that's to politicians, media or public.
Okay. And we are going to get to killer jewels in a second, which is, of course, the most interesting bit. But on diversity inclusion, It's a bit of a hot topic at the moment, because how do we make, what can we do in practical terms to make that better? Because whenever we go to an energy conference, there is clearly a lack of diversity, not just diversity, however you measure it, right? And the resultant impact is diversity of thought. But whichever metric you're looking at, we're not doing very well on it. What do we do? What's the state of play right now? How bad is it? And then what do we need to do to fix it?
So I think gender we've got a lot better at. We still, ethnicity, we're getting there, but still have a long way to go. But then there's areas like disability, neurodiversity, socioeconomic background and things like that, where people just aren't even aware of that as a diverse form, and they're not thinking about it at all. And I used to get the same thing. We used to go to the conferences, and especially diversity conferences, and everyone would always say the same thing every single year. Like, we've done a lot. We know we've got a long way to go, but we've done more than last year. And yeah, we've got a long way to go, essentially. And so we do an EDI conference every year. And last year, because I was just like, I don't want to come back next year and say the same stuff and nothing happen in between. So we launched a task force. Call it a task force. It's more of a group of volunteers, but it's called TIDE, Tackling Inclusion and Diversity in Energy. And the idea was to bring together people from across the industry who are doing some really good work in this space, because there is good work happening. So, for example, Pride in Energy, Powerful Women, we've got our Young Energy Professionals, which is a really cool group of early careers, people like Energy and Utility Skills, who do a lot of data measurement in that area. So we got all of those people and brought them together into a group to see if we could take a cross-industry approach. So it's moving slowly, but we're doing some bits. We've been doing webinars for industry. We're building up an EDI hub where people can submit best practice case studies to help industry learn. We've launched a leaders commitment and a health index so that companies can check where they're at compared to other companies. So, but the thing I always say when I talk about TIDE is it's not about reinventing the wheel. Like, I really don't want to be starting anything new when there's already stuff going on. So it's more about signposting people to where there's the information, because I've never written an EDI strategy, but if you showed me three good ones, I could probably easily write one that's good for our business. So it's about trying to make it as easy as possible for companies in the energy industry to improve their diversity, essentially.
And so what are the outcomes of, so if you guys have an EDI conference every year, do you set targets, or is this something, does this need to happen at a government level, or is it the big companies that need to change practices, or the small companies? From personal experience, it's something that we struggle with for all the obvious reasons, which is, like, you put a job up and you get, like, you don't have a diverse pool of candidates.
Yeah.
And so we need to think long term about how we fix this. I don't think it's a short term thing, but yeah, what should
we do? I totally agree. No, and it's the same. You know, it's the same in events, right? You're trying to get a diverse panel of speakers on events. Same with, we're looking at our board governance at the minute, right? How do we get a diverse board? Does that mean that actually we need to drop levels of seniority if we want to make sure that we've got that diversity around the table? So, yeah, it is. I think it's a dual pronged approach. I think so. We workshopped what TIDE's priorities were at the conference, the first conference when we said that we were going to do it. And it came back with kind of insight gathering, sharing best practice and engaging with leaders. And that we can't set targets because we don't even have the data. Like, that's how far behind we are. We don't even know, again, with gender, because Powerful Women do it, and because it's slightly easier because you've got the gender pay gap and things like that, where there's ways that you can quite easily collect that data. But then when you start digging into it and you're relying on employees giving you data and they don't have to, so then how do you collect that data? So we're doing a big piece of work on data at the minute. Then there's the, like, quick wins, and that is about sharing best practice, which sounds like a really, like, lame answer to it. But actually, like I said, if you can just see what someone else has done and they've done it really well, and then you can implement that yourself, then it does just make that whole journey easier. But then it is that top-down approach with leaders. And I think the analogy I always give is, like, if you work in an operational company, health and safety, it's everybody's responsibility. Yeah, you've got a health and safety team, but it's everyone's responsibility. And I've worked on projects, offshore wind projects, where I've seen somebody stop a project, £4 billion project, because they weren't convinced that something was safe. And they knew they weren't going to get into trouble for that, right? Because health and safety is right the way through the company. And if you set that culture with EDI, where it's everybody's responsibility, where someone knows they're not going to get into trouble if they just go the extra mile to make sure that something's right or done in the right way and is inclusive, then I think a lot of it is around culture and what comes from the top and the leaders. And we're really lucky in Energy UK. We actually have an all-female exco, which you could argue is not diverse, actually. So it's just three of us. But Emma and Dara, the CEO and the deputy CEO, they're really hot on this. And we take a zero tolerance approach to any sort of behaviour that isn't inclusive. We have strict rules on our panels, no all male panels and things like that. So it's, yeah, we're trying to do what we can, both for our own organisation, but then through Tide, we're trying to nudge industry along as well.
I wonder, I was just thinking if there's another industry that's managed to pull this off. So I wonder if there's anything out there that we can point to that over a period, I don't know what is a good amount of time, right? Say a decade, that managed to turn it around. Because if this takes two generations to fix, it's just not good. That's not good enough.
Water, actually, it's probably better than the energy industry in that sense, actually, I think. I think the rail industry has done quite a lot. I heard a stat and I don't want to repeat it because it sounds awful, but I think it was something like the only industry that's worse than energy is like the tobacco industry or something like that. I can't remember what it was. It was something really bad, but yeah. And we do need to, and I think energy especially, we've got people that are working offshore. So it's as much about the physical environment as it is about the office space. There's no toilets on turbines, which means that if you're a woman, it makes things a little bit harder if you need to go for a wee. It's those simple things about making the physical environment comfortable. That might have changed actually now, but there certainly wasn't a few years ago. But making the physical environment as much as the office environment inclusive as well.
Well, without sounding like one of the people at the conference that really wound you up, we do have lots of work to do, and I bloody hope we do it. But now I want to talk about kilojoules. So you might have to go and get changed and come back with your alter ego on. You've got the wind farm earrings on. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So now back to the other side of you, kilojoules. So what is the idea behind kilojoules?
The idea was to engage the public in a creative way with the wonderful world of energy. And it's gone a bit wider than wind. Initially, it was wind, and most of my products are wind related. But yeah, so it started off in lockdown. And initially, it was about taking music, like tunes that people would know, mainly 90s tunes, although I've branched out a little bit now, and changing the words so that they were about energy. So like the review of the electricity market arrangements, REMA. So I did a Craig David version of that, was like REMA, or like got Destiny's Child or Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. So that was about just how can we make it a bit more fun for people to learn about wind energy and energy in general. And then it expanded accidentally into an earring business, because I made some earrings, not these ones here, come on right here, some little wind turbine earrings. I went on a jewelry course and made these, and then like as a joke on LinkedIn, I was like, oh, does anyone want to buy a pair? And then I'd had like 150 people get in touch. Then I was like, oh crap, better make those. So that was fun. And then I dressed up as a wind turbine at festivals and evenings and weekends, just to spread the wonderful word about wind. Yeah.
And so, of course, we're going to put links in the show notes to all of the YouTube videos. But some of these videos have really taken off, right? You got a lot of views on these. So what are the big hitters?
The best one, the best song tune, industry's favourite, is All About The Blades, which is to All About The Bass. All About The Blades. Yeah. About the It's really funny. My friend was in a meeting and he was messaging me and he was like, Jules, they've literally just kicked off the meeting with your track. And like, they didn't know that we were mates. And it's funny. Every once in a while, I'll be at an industry event and we'll get chatting with someone and someone's like, whoa, you're killer Jules. It's not a secret who I am. But I love that kind of stuff. I think it's really important. And my mates all love offshore wind, not because they're mates with me, but because I talk about it in a really excited, passionate way. And you can get those facts across. It's things like, rather than saying one turbine can power 16,000 European households, which I don't know what that means, but instead of saying that, you say one spin can power a home for over 2 days, and people get that and then they want to know more. And it sounds like I'm joking around, but the turbine suit, actually, when you wear it, like, people genuinely, they come up to you and they ask you questions, not only about wind, but then about the wider energy system. And I think it's important to engage with the public, both because so they can make informed decisions about how they're voting, about how they think about things. Politicians care about how people feel about either onshore wind, offshore wind, all this sort of stuff. So it's important to get the facts out there.
And so that's an interesting point you made there about communicating that this how many homes can you power for a year thing. It's everywhere. The funniest thing is that it even turns up in press releases about battery energy storage, which of course is like a 1 hour or 2 hour duration thing. There is so much artistic license in these press releases. So what have you got any other top tips about communicating these kind of things? So that's a good one, right? How many houses from one spin? What other ways can we cut this data and information when we're talking to other people about this amazing industry?
Well, number one tip of anything, just make it really simple and don't use language that people don't understand. You know, like just think about talking to your mates. We use so many acronyms in energy that it's just impossible. So yeah, use really simple language. But then in terms of the comparisons, we used to have loads of fun on like the size of them. So comparing that to buildings, and we did BBC Breakfast once. That really tall guy, Ben, I can't remember his surname, but there's a really, really tall guy who presents BBC Breakfast, and he came down and we were like, worked out how many of him tall the turbines were and things like that, or the area that they cover. Like Hornsea One covers an area bigger than Greater London, right? That's massive. But wow. If you say that in kilometres squared, I don't know what that is, but if you say it in terms of how it compares, I think we used to say bigger than Malta, and then everyone was like, how big is Malta?
Also, it feels like a bit of a shots fired at Malta a little bit.
No, none at all. But yeah, so I think, yeah, comparisons, I guess, are good. And then I used to do it, get like an American journalist coming over, and then instead of using how many Big Ben's tall it was, you'd compare it to the Statue of Liberty or something, or Blade is 9.5 buses long. Like, people can get that and they can understand
nine
it.
9.5 buses
yeah,
long. Wow.
Massive, 107 metres. Yeah, you could fit an elephant in the root of a turbine blade. Not that you would ever want to.
Should have done this as a quick fire. It's like a top trump of all of your comparisons. So
this
you
is what I'm genuinely like in the pub. Like, my mates you can, are just you like,
can,
yeah.
You can yeah. fit an elephant inside a wind turbine blade.
In the root of the blade. Yeah. In the absolutely root of the blade. Yeah.
Wow. Have someone
challenge on. There you go.
Yeah, exactly. That should be an episode
come
of something.
Come on.
Any more tidbits?
What about? Yeah, try and make it. Also, try and make it engaging and funny. I used to do the social media at Orsted, and that was really fun because it was a bit. You had a bit more license with the tone of voice to be funny about things. So we'd do stupid stuff like at National Emoji Day, and we'd spell out a sentence just in emojis about our wind farm. So you do like Hornsea, or like when I was at Equinor, you do like dog or bank. Like, so I have a dog and then an R and then a bank. Which it sounds stupid, but if you can get people in with that, and then you hit them with the facts, then it's, yeah, and you get them.
And so to finish up, one last question before we get onto the two special ones. What do we need to convince? So you specialize in communicating around energy stuff, right? Communicating complex stuff and making it interesting and easy to understand. If we really need to send a message to the general public or government, what are the big trends that we need to make sure that they hear loud and clear about our industry, and maybe some things that we just need to provide some clarity around?
I think decarbonizing homes and bringing sort of people along with us in the journey to net zero is really important. And so there's a lot of myths out there about smart meters, about heat pumps, and also it's, you know, aside from the comms, it's actually quite difficult sometimes for people to know where to go to get the right information and to navigate that system to install a heat pump or anything like that. So I think there's something there around bringing people with us and making sure that they have access to the right information, making sure that we're supporting vulnerable people along in that journey, and that it's as easy as possible for them to do that. Because if we're going to decarbonize, energy affects everyone. It's going to be every single person's home that has to get up to that net zero standard. And I think at the minute, around 50% of our homes are lower than EPCC, which is the sort of minimum rating. So there's something there around engaging with people and making sure that they have access to the right information. And then the other big bit for government is, like I said, it's not losing the leading position that we had in the investment in low carbon technology, because the difference between this piece of work that we've just done with Oxford Economics, it looked at four different scenarios to net zero. So one is the current trajectory. One was a delayed scenario, one was just meeting net zero, and one was if we really get a move on and accelerate that. And the difference between the accelerated scenario and the one that we're currently in, the difference in GVA to the UK is the entire manufacturing sector right now as it is, 240 billion. And that's just the difference, right? So that's
the difference in what, sorry? What's
in
the
gross value added. So the difference in basically how much it boosts the economy of those two scenarios is equivalent to the entire manufacturing sector as it is today. And that's just a matter of how quickly we get on with it. And again, if you compare those two scenarios, it changes massively how much of that funding comes from the private sector. So the private sector will fund 70% of the money required to get to net zero, the investment required. But again, looking at those difference in scenarios, it's £165 billion more comes from the private sector if we just get a move on with it. And so when you think about that, means that then less comes from the public sector, which means that it's cheaper for everybody overall. So there's a big message of urgency, really, and just that, like, the next year, the next decade, all of it is really important, and we haven't got time to mess around with general elections and things like that. Like, the work needs to continue in the background as we get onto that. Grid is another big thing. There needs to be investment in grid so that it can both take increased amounts of electricity. Obviously, as we move more to decarbonised heating and transport, there's going to be, you know, a need for more electricity. I think it's 50% more by 2035. So how can we make sure that we have a grid that both can handle that, but also can move electricity around the country in the right way? Because there's no point in generating a load of wind up in Scotland if you can't get it to where you need it. So it's, yeah, there's that. There's the queuing system at the minute for grid connections. I think projects at the minute are waiting up to 15 years to get a connection. So there's a lot of the nuts and boltsy bits that need sorting out. Yeah.
All right. Now on to the last two questions. The first one is, if you've got something to plug, this is a special slot where you get to plug whatever you want here.
Great.
The second question is your contrarian view. What do you believe that most people don't? But we'll do the first one first. Anything you need to plug?
Yes. If you are listening to this and you are not an Energy UK member, then definitely head to our website.
Shameless. I wouldn't rate that.
So as I said, we have a very high profile, both in media and in government. We're trusted because we look across the whole system. And as a member, you get benefits such as access to our insights and analysis, events that we run. You get member discount training, things like that, and networking opportunities, and we can help raise your profile in when we're speaking to media and government. But also on our website is the Clean Growth Gap, and this is the series that I've been talking about, this series of reports about investment that we've done with Oxford Economics. Yeah, and there's some really good stats in there. And then also,
Access that stuff for free.
Yeah, all of that's for free. No, you need to give me £5,000 and be a member. No, joking. that kind of stuff we do make available for free, because obviously we share it with politicians and think tanks and things like that, because it's we want people to see that case, because they're the ones making the decisions, right? So it wouldn't be good if we just kept it for ourselves. But yeah, and then the Kilojoules website, of course, where you can buy lovely earrings like these and the ones that I showed earlier.
Awesome. And now the contrarian view. What is it?
Yeah, this one was a bit hard to think about because I am paid to take an industry consensus view. So it wouldn't be right for me to come in here and start saying stuff. So I think what I will say that it's probably consensus across the whole industry, and is that I think we need to do better at engaging with the public. I think the contrarian view is that I think we can do it through the arts. I think there's loads of cool opportunities where actually we could engage with, imagine taking Bonobo offshore to a wind farm, or getting graffiti artists on turbines. I don't know, just something just to drum up a bit more noise in a funner, more creative way about energy. And that could be from, I've always thought it'd be really cool going to a school, brief one half of the class about nuclear, brief one half of the class about offshore wind, and get them to have a rap battle or something like that. Just get them talking about it. So yeah.
So lots more to be done in the arts. I saw Coldplay have got some sort of, that they've been doing some stuff with dance floors that generate electricity. It's probably a bit too far down the I know it's portraying a message, but I'm not sure I really believed it. But definitely there's a lot more to be done in the arts. I couldn't back that enough. And yeah, funneling more money into the arts in general sounds like a good thing to me.
Exactly. And I think we're going to need hundreds of thousands of people to come work in this sector, and we've got to find ways to reach them. And so, yeah, a few years back, I did a documentary with BBC, and we took a window. We took a crew out offshore to Hornsea One. And it was amazing, but it was a proper logistical challenge, sorting out film crew, going from vessel to vessel, up to the top of a wind turbine, all this sort of stuff. And it came out, it was a half an hour programme all about the wind farm. And you do it and you're like, great, this is my job. Great, I've done it. And my sister was like, why? I was like, because it's important that people understand about this sort of stuff. And then a few years later, one of my old colleagues called me, and they said that they'd had a person that was training to be a hairdresser apprentice, or training to be a hairdresser. And they'd seen the programme, and as a result of the programme, they'd then decided to train to be a wind turbine technician. And it's like, that's why what I do is really cool. That's why comms is important. And that's why I think it is important to get out to the public and talk about what we're doing as an industry.
Agreed.
And that's why you guys do such a great job, right? Your podcasts, your Energy Academy.
We do it for all the good reasons, but I think most of all we do it because it's fun.
Yeah. Well, that's why I do kilojoules. I do it's all in my spare time. And I always tell myself I'm never going to do it if it gets stressful. And that's why I've been sitting on a Snoop Dogg, Dogger Bank song since March. That's like, it's like 80% of the way there. But I just can't look at it at the minute because I'm just not in the right mind for it. But, I won't do it until I'm ready to do it. And that's, it should be fun, I think, if you're going to do stuff like that, right? Especially if it's in your spare time.
Which Snoop song is it? Out of interest.
It's my name. What's my name? So it's like, it's Dogger Bank.
Very good.
Yeah. There you go. Sneak preview.
I hope it's
I'm going to do it.
Yeah. No, you do have to do it. All right. Juliet or kilojoules? I want to say a massive thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you.
If you listen to this and you want to hear more about what kilojoules or Juliet Sanders or Energy UK are up to, we're going to put some links in the notes so you can check them out. Do check out the report that you guys did with Oxford Economics as well. We're going to go away and read that. And of course, if you're listening to this and you like it, hit like, subscribe, and all those buttons. It really means the world to us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.